listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
I woke this morning to the promise of a new day peeking through my curtain, a sliver of white light that broke through the darkness in the bedroom. A bird chirped somewhere beyond, and behind my front door, Tuesday was waiting for me to step into it, and that I could step into it to walk, taste, listen, touch, smell, and see the new day is a liberty I take for granted. With tonight's authors on my mind, my morning reflection was ever more poignant. In this eloquently written narrative of the improbable outcome of a simple hike through the Iraqi countryside, Bauer, Fatal, and Shord take us into their grueling experience in Evin prison in northwestern Iran, where Sarah was locked up for 410 days and Shane and Josh for 781. The emotionally evocative story is both reflective and descriptive, from seeing the inside of the cell of our hostages, which is the name to which they refer themselves, to an understanding of their love for the Middle East, the reasons that brought them to this point, and the overarching ethos that guides them as a unit, three spirits committed to living in solidarity in the most trying of conditions while living as political pawns of the Iranian government. It is quite rare to have the opportunity to step into their world like this. Our three authors, not just brave victors in this battle, but truly gifted storytellers who are committed to sharing with the world so that we all gain a better understanding of what is at stake in the complex arena of international relations and the flawed justice system, both at home and abroad. The structure of the book is strikingly beautiful, three voices interwoven together, each contributing parts to the bigger narrative, one person picking up where the other leaves off. Their enduring and deep bond of friendship informs the skillful manner in which all of their contributions blend together so fluidly. Despite the horrific situation in which they found themselves, the authors are able to note the generosity of spirit of another prisoner. They attempt to see humanity in the eyes of their captors, and they never cease reaching for the sliver of light that streams into their cell, specks of dust illuminated in the morning light. Our authors tonight are Sarah Shord, educator, contributing editor at Solidarity Watch, and a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. Shord is also a human rights activist with the organization United for Iran, which supports the movement for genuine democratic reform in Iran and to improve human rights conditions inside the country. Josh Fatal is a PhD candidate at NYU in history with a background in environmental sustainability. Prior to his arrest in Iran, he taught in Asia, Africa, and Europe about the political economy of healthcare and was co-director of an environmental education system in Oregon. Shane Bauer is an award-winning investigative journalist and photographer. In 2003, he received the John J. Henry Frank Guggenheim Award for Excellence in Criminal Justice Reporting. He is the author of the piece No Way Out in Mother Jones Magazine that profiles California's Pelican Bay State Prison, written with the unique perspective of someone who has lived in solitary confinement himself. And moderating our conversation tonight, we are honored to have with us Arun Rath, weekend host of All Things Considered. Previously, Rath was a senior reporter for the PBS series Frontline and The World on WGBH Boston, where he specialized in national security and military justice. He has produced three films for Frontline, the latest being an investigation of alleged war crimes committed by U.S. Marines in Iraq. Please join me in welcoming tonight's authors to Aloud at the L.A. Public Library.
Wow. Lou, thank you all very much for joining us. I'm very excited to speak with the three of you about this book, and it's almost an interviewer cliche to say, I feel like I know you after reading your book, but I think this one in particular, there's something about prison narratives, right? Where you're living so much in your head, so much of the time that it's, well, there's nothing really to do but reflect, right?
Yeah.
I think probably a good way to start would be to have a reading from the book, and I think to get us going, we talked about Josh. If you could read close to the beginning, this is very close to the right at the beginning of the action in the book. You're Shane, why don't you set up the hike that you guys were on? Set the scene a little bit.
Okay. Well, Sarah and I were actually living in Syria at the time. I was working as a journalist. Sarah was teaching English. Josh had been traveling around the world and was teaching. And Josh came to visit us along with another friend, and we decided to take a trip to northern Iraq, to Iraqi Kurdistan, which is an autonomous part of Iraq. There's a couple million tourists visit there every year. It was actually in 2011 on the New York Times top 41 place to visit in the world. And we were there for a couple of days and went out. We asked our hotel manager if there was a good place to get out of the city. We asked a taxi driver. They both told us to go to this place called Ahmedawa, which was a waterfall area. And we went there, and there were hundreds of Kurdish people, families, camping out. It was kind of a local tourist area. And we spent the night there, and the next day we hiked on a trail, and we hiked for quite a while, for maybe 5 hours.
But before we set this up, I also want to talk a little bit about your backgrounds, because, well, first off, you're not inexperienced hikers, and you didn't just sort of come to the area out of nowhere. You and Sarah had lived in, you were living in Damascus, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At that time. Yeah. And working,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. We'd been in the Middle East for over a year. We traveled through Yemen, Lebanon, and settled in Syria, where I was teaching Iraqi refugees and helping them get into college in the U.S. and abroad.
I'd been kind of going back and forth for a while. I'd spent a few years in the Middle East before that and speak Arabic, and had been worked in Baghdad before, and which is a very different part, you know, place in Iraqi Kurdistan.
And how old were all of you at this time when you're on this hike?
I just turned 27.
Sarah? Yeah. 30.
I was 27 also. Yeah.
So, Josh.
So we're on the hike.
Yeah, you're on the hike.
And let me actually back up a moment and say, we're on the hike, we just took a rest stop, and then, here it goes. And just as we're setting out, Sarah stops in her tracks. She looks concerned. There's a soldier on the ridge. He's got a gun, she says. He's waving us up the trail. I pause for a second and look at my friends. They seem worried, but not alarmed. Maybe it's an Iraqi army outpost. We stride silently uphill. I can feel my heart pounding against my ribs, but I want to look cool and confident. A different soldier with a green uniform and a rifle waits for us where our road meets the ridge. He's standing in front of a round stone building that we had previously looked at and decided would be our destination. He's young and nonchalant, and he beckons us to him with a wave. He doesn't seem hostile. When we finally approach him, he asks, "Farsi?" "Faranzi," Shane asks, then continues in Arabic. "I don't speak French. Do you speak Arabic?" "Shane," I whisper urgently. "He didn't ask if we speak French. He asked if we speak Farsi." As I speak, I notice the red, white, and green flag on the soldier's lapel. These aren't Iraqi soldiers, Kurdish rebels, Al-Qaeda, or mountain lions, all of which we've speculated about. We're in Iran. We follow the Iranian soldier along the other side of the ridge to a small, unmarked building. Around us, mountains unfold in all directions. There's no flag, nothing marking the building as Iranian, only a dozen soldiers in uniform milling around the building.
So at that point, you obviously realize that you're in some amount of trouble.
Yeah.
Or maybe not some amount of trouble, but you're not in a good area. Now, just to get a sense, because this is really right next to where you were seeing that idyllic scene with the waterfall families. There were like tourist stands for people selling food.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then how far away was this?
It was pretty far. I mean, we hiked up from there for several hours. So the tourist area was kind of down the valley.
We wanted to get to the top of the ridge. We wanted to see the view. And it was right maybe a few hundred feet from the top of the ridge when we saw the soldier, and he motioned for us to come to him.
Now when he motioned to you, was your understanding, were you still in Iraq at that point when he was beckoning to you?
Well, 2.5 years later, one of those soldiers contacted me over Facebook, and at first I assumed, you know, I didn't believe him that he was, I remembered him clearly. He was the one that spoke the most English, and he had a English Farsi dictionary, so we were able to communicate a little bit. And when I said, you called us into Iran, he said, you are true, at the time. And he, at first I thought, well, how do I know you're that soldier? But he knew every single detail of our conversation. And so I believed him, and he confirmed that the trail we were on was the border. So the soldiers motioned for us to come to them off the trail into Iran.
And he actually apologized.
He did apologize.
Facebook, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, turns out he also apologized for.
He also asked me to help him with his music career.
Are you going to do that? I mean, you're not really in a position to with the place you work, but so you see the flag. You hear Farsi. Is that the point where you just kind of go cold and you realize this is one of those moments where everything changes?
I mean, I feel like it. I mean, there was. We were shocked. I think all of us were shocked. But it also, at least, I assumed that we would, you know, it wouldn't last very long. You know, we would the kind of, you know, that we would they would understand there was misunderstanding. We would go talk to some people, maybe get interrogated for a day, and then be allowed to go back to Iran.
Clearly not soldiers, and right. Pretty obviously not spies if anybody were to look very closely.
And at that point, it seemed like the farthest, it seemed impossible that we would spend a night even. I mean, there was just no reason for them to suspect us. The first thing that they did is they stopped so that I could buy a hijab, because in Iran, that's mandatory for a woman to wear, you know, to be very covered. In northern Iraq and Iraqi Kurdistan, women dress however they want. So from the get-go, we would have been arrested just because of how I was dressed.
There was, looking back, I mean, there were so many moments and layers to it sinking in, you know? And it was that layer of like, okay, well, they see we have American passports. There's like the layer when they put us in the SUV and drove us down the hill. And then there's the layer where they buy the hijab and they take us to a police station. There, you know, looking, there's so many. But if this moment that I read was probably the moment that I thought a lot about, maybe most about in solitary confinement, and thought that's when I could have ran. I don't know if it would have been that smart. The guy had a gun. But, you know, you obsess about every little detail, and so the mind thinks about those sorts of things.
Let's have one more reading, Shane. This is one of those points at which, again, fairly early on, where it's starting to sink in just right. How bad the situation is.
Yeah, we were just in an apartment building in a city. We didn't know what city it was. We had been interrogated, and at nighttime they put us in a car and drove us out of the city. So we're driving. "He's got a gun," Josh says, startled but calm. "He just put it on the dash." In a busy roundabout, our car swerves to avoid an oncoming vehicle. The pistol falls from the dash and scuds across the floor. My heart stops and my mouth goes dry. The pudgy man picks it up and sets it on his lap. We turn onto a road that leads out of town. The city lights fade behind us. "Where are we going?" Sarah asks in a disarming, honey-sweet voice. "Sss," the pudgy man hisses, turning around to face us and putting his finger to his lips. The headlights of the car trailing us light up his face, revealing his cold, bored eyes. He turns back to face the front. The solitary lights of the country houses stream by like little meteorites. The car falls silent again. He picks up the gun in his right hand and cocks it 3 times. Sarah's eyes widen. Her posture stiffens. She leans toward the man in front and, with a note of desperation, says, "Ahmadinejad, good. Obama, bad." The pistol is resting on his lap. He turns to face us again and holds his 2 hands out with palms facing each other. Iran, he says, nodding his head toward one hand. America, he says, lifting the other. Problem, he says, stretching out the distance between them. He checks our faces to make sure his message registered, then drops his arms.
And it seems worth, you know, maybe it's kind of obvious, but pointing out the political context in which, you know, the three of you were taken captive, because it looked like there might have been a bit of detente heading into the beginning of the Obama administration, but then, political events in Iran kind of turned in another direction.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, just a few months is when the Green Movement erupted in the capitals of Iran, millions of people protesting Ahmadinejad being reelected, saying that he stole the vote. And of course, the prisons were full of dissidents.
Just most people probably know this, but the U.S. was very supportive of the Shah of Iran in the decades after the World War II. And the revolution, the Islamic Revolution in 1979, overthrew the Shah and Iran became enemies with the U.S. And U.S. had a hostile policy towards Iran, and Iran had a hostile policy towards the U.S. for several decades by the point that we got there. And Obama came to power with some promises towards detente, and then there was this movement. But Obama hadn't acted on anything at that point. It was still this sort of systematic policy of isolating Iran and heavy sanctions and these sorts of things.
There's this uneasy period in the beginning as well where each of you are hoping they don't find out certain details about you. Josh, I mean, to state an obvious one, you're Jewish. Mm. And in a place like, and your background is, your father's an Iraqi Jew, right?
Yeah.
Does that make two big strikes in a place like Iran?
It's not that they, you know, don't like Iraq or something, but it was just the story could be woven even easier because I, you know, family connections, because we were in Iraq, of course, and then my father moved from Iraq to Israel. Israel is even more of a great Satan than America's great Satan, and so that was my big fear, you know, and I didn't know if they would, you know, treat me differently for it, but I figured I'd better hedge my bets.
And you've been to Israel, right?
Yeah,
Was that on your passport? Is that something they saw?
It wasn't actually on that passport, but
they have more than one passport sometimes.
It had expired in between, but I, you know, half my family is in Israel, my whole father's side of my family. So, I had, you know, been several times to visit, and I was very wary of how to talk about that or to talk about it at all.
And it forces each of you to do kind of an assessment of your own life. I mean, they're forcing you to confess, and basically, at one point, you're made to write out your biography, right?
Many points. That was a routine. You know, we'd go into interrogation, and they'd say, either in interrogation or they'd send us off with ream of paper and say, write your complete biography. We had to do it over and over again, and, you know, complete biography is a hard thing to write in 9 pages.
I don't mean to be flip about it, because it's a ghastly thing that you're going through, but it's like an enforced writer's workshop. Did you have a sense of, like, did you get insight out of this?
It wasn't like really creative writing.
Forcefully reflect on what got you to where you were at that point.
The first time I wrote my lengthy biography, it felt like it was 20 or 30 pages. They looked it over, and they tore it up and threw it at my feet and told me to do it again, so apparently...
But it was also, I think the act of doing that was kind of a relief in a sense because, you know, we were all in solitary confinement at the time. And that was just ending up in a prison and being put right in solitary confinement was really difficult. And I quickly started to kind of hope for my interrogators to come so that I could, you know, have some conversation, be writing for hours to kind of move the time along.
I think you picked up on something that we wrote about too that's worth articulating is that, you know, in isolation, I had this feeling of like, wait, who am I? Like, what am I doing here? There's nobody to talk to. I kind of start to forget, like, if these memories are real, you know, after a certain amount of time. So being in an interrogation and saying like, this is what I did. I was this age, and I moved to this city, and I believe in this, and I, it was a way to kind of confirm and articulate my identity in a place where that was on very shaky ground.
And you, Sarah, if you could read from the part that we talked about earlier, because we'll get a sense of what you guys did to fight the isolation. You actually had to, went on a hunger strike. If you read, maybe set up if you want to.
Sure. Yeah, the initial days when we were being driven around Iran and we had no idea where we were. It was just empty landscapes or small towns, salt flats. And then, of course, when we got to Tehran, they blindfolded us and took us to the prison and tore us apart. And we decided if they separated us, we would immediately start hunger striking. So this is the early weeks of interrogation. Sarah, eat this cookie. Not until I see Shane and Josh. I'm sitting blindfolded in a school chair. A cookie sits on the desk in front of me. The interrogator is saying something to me. What is it? I have to force myself to focus. Do you think we care if you eat, Sarah? They do care. I know that much. I've been on hunger strike since they split us up 2 days ago. At first it was difficult not eating, but I'm learning how to conserve energy. When I stand up, my heart beats furiously in my chest, so I lie on my back on the floor most of the day, sleeping as much as I can. Terrible thoughts and images occupy my mind. My mom balled up on the floor screaming when she learns I've been captured. Masked prison guards coming into my cell to rape me. But I found ways to distract myself, like slowly going over multiplication tables in my head. I do this for hours at a time, starting with the twos and going up to the teens until I have to stop and start over again. When it becomes impossible to continue, I sing songs to myself in a whisper. Sarah, why did you come to the Middle East to live in Damascus? The interrogator asks. Don't you miss your family, your country? Yes, of course I do, but it's only for a couple of years. I can't believe you're asking me this. Do you realize how scared and worried my family must be? It's horrible what you're doing. Why can't I make a phone call and tell them I'm alive?
It was kind of remarkable to me. Remarkable to me when I read that for the first time. I was just surprised that you would all have that resolve so early on to go on hunger strike right away.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think any of us knows exactly how the decision happened. It was just a gut impulse. I mean, all of us have read memoirs of political prisoners, Angela Davis, Malcolm X. That's what political prisoners do.
We figured we should play the role.
And the idea of being separated, you know, we're in this situation suddenly that none of us expected, and the idea of being separated was terrifying. So we just, you know, thought, what can we possibly do to make sure that doesn't happen? And, you know, that seemed like the only possibility.
You end up getting transferred to Evin prison?
Yeah.
Evin prison, the notorious prison. In Iran, are you aware of what's going on at the time when you're getting transferred there? Is what's going through your mind at that point?
Well, we were actually in Evin prison the whole time. It's kind of a large prison compound, and we were initially in one ward within it that we now think was controlled by the Revolutionary Guard. And after a month, we were transferred to where we remained, which was a unit controlled by the Ministry of Intelligence, Section 209, and there were a lot of things going through our heads. I mean, we were taken out and, did you want to say something?
No, you can't.
Okay. We were, taken out. It was like, oh, okay, this is a month. I can't believe I've been here a month. Finally, it's over. This is like crazy, you know? And, we saw each other for the first time
and they gave us our stuff.
Yeah. They gave us our stuff. They said, you know, I said, can I have my passport? And the guy said, I'll send it to you soon. And I said, where are you going to send it to me to? And he said, you're going to go somewhere not far from here. And we were brought to this other part of the prison. And just the psychology, at least, that was going on with me was I kept thinking every step of the way, the way that I got myself through it was think, okay, now this is one step closer to freedom, even though things were getting worse and worse and worse, you know. Mm-hmm. We were brought to a new place, and I remember saying to Sarah and Josh, okay, they blindfolded us, and I said, okay, you know, this, we're closer to trial, something like that, and we remained there for another 25 months, Josh and I did.
Mm-hmm. And I had the same thing. I mean, from the get-go, it's like there's multiple narratives playing in your head, and of course you want to believe the best possible outcome. At least for months, I was able to continue to have that hope, and you want to?
Yeah, I remember when, which one of you said, the airport is, or they're taking us somewhere close.
Yeah.
And I was just in, I was just convinced we were getting free. I was like, this has to be now, you know? And I had heard airplanes and helicopters kind of distantly out my window. So I was like, well, the airport's close, guys, if that's where they're taking us. And of course we pull up and there's like this, you know, gray building with a bunch of bars on it. And we're like, oh, it's not an airport.
You know, that's kind of a classic psychological torture to pull on prisoners. Do you think that's what they were doing? Were they just doing that to you? I think
they do it so you don't resist. Yeah. As long as you don't know how desperate your situation is, you'll go along with it.
Yeah.
I think I know the answer to this question, but you know, there's a debate in this country, excuse me, about solitary confinement and whether it constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. Thoughts?
Well, the UN says that 15 days in solitary confinement can cause lasting, permanent psychological damage. We were all in solitary confinement, Shane and Josh, for 4 months, and I was there the entire time for 410 days. And studies show that after 2 or 3 days, your brainwaves start to shift towards stupor or delirium. So yes, I undoubtedly think that it's psychological torture.
And just to be clear, there's at least 80,000 people in solitary confinement in this country. Places, I went to Pelican Bay Prison after I got out, and there are people that were held there in windowless cells for 10, 20, 30, 40 years in solitary confinement. I met a man there who hadn't seen a tree in 12 years. And many of these people hadn't actually committed violent acts within the prison. They were put there because they were organizing protests over conditions. They had, books. One guy had an academic book about the Black Panthers, and, you know, that put him in for 20 years.
And two-thirds of people are mentally ill before they're put in solitary confinement, and, of course, many more come out with more mental illness. So it's often the difficult problem prisoners that don't obey the rules, don't walk fast enough, that get put in the hole because it's easier.
I've become kind of a history nerd, and so I want to share this one, you know, because I feel like that question has to do with kind of our moral sensibility and what is cruel and unusual punishment. And, you know, I learned that in the 17th century New England, the Puritans thought that 6 months of detention, any kind of detention, not solitary confinement, was considered cruel and unusual. And so something has happened where our moral sensibility is such that people can end up without seeing trees for decades and things.
You know, Sarah, when I was reading your account, I was thinking about, I covered the Chelsea Manning court-martial, and there was a lot of accounts about the time that Private Manning was in solitary confinement.
And mm-hmm.
It was a lot of the same things to keep saying, like singing out loud, these things that would ordinarily be taken as a marker of madness are the things that keep you sane in that kind of situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything about solitary confinement. Solitary confinement is kind of a microcosm of the whole prison system. Everything about it is meant to break you, to dehumanize you, to make you easy to control. So the only way to resist it is to keep your humanity alive and to be creative, to try to use that space, that 10 by 14 foot space. I would see how many pirouettes I could do across the cell without stumbling. I got up to 17 at one point. I would crawl on my back, I don't know what that's called, back and forth as fast as I could, and wait till the guards, you know, when you, a bridge pose, but you're back walking?
Crab.
I would crab a lot. Some of the other prisoners, I mean, that was something I'm sure we'll talk about at length, but a woman next to me started to knock, and she would do a few knocks, and then I would knock back and add something, and then she would add something else, and we would compose music together.
I think it's really hard to. It was hard for me to know whether I was going crazy or not in solitary confinement because, there's no. I felt like I couldn't know if I was going crazy unless I could see somebody else to have that reflection, you know, to see how somebody reacts to me because it's just this slow change. I mean, the days are moving slowly. My mind started to really slow down to the point that I wasn't really thinking much. And, you know, sometimes I'd sing loudly, talk to myself, And it's like, is that me trying to be, you know, get through this? Is that me going crazy? There's no context left, you know? It's just, you're just a body in a room.
I remember reading that Chelsea Manning was making faces in the mirror, and they were saying, well, he's really gone off the deep end because he's making faces in the mirror. And I was kind of like, man, if I had a mirror, I would have been, you know, that's like obvious.
It was the most bizarre. It was an actual literal catch-22 situation of the things that he was doing to keep himself sane.
Mm-hmm. No, really.
Being used as evidence of that he was, unstable. No. Now, the conditions changed. I mean, for Josh, for you and Shane, you were able to end up rooming together, ultimately. And it was, it's sort of hard to say. I mean, the suffering the three of you went through, I mean, Sarah, you were by yourself all that time, and then, but the two of you ended up staying longer. I don't know how it breaks up, but that must have been really hard for you, still just being by yourself at that.
It was one of the many demons I had to fight, and that's the hardest thing in solitary confinement is to not, become your worst self, you know, to still rise to the occasion every single day. And that was one of the broken records. Once I knew that they were together in a cell, all I could do was imagine the two of them playing chess, having a leisurely conversation, giving each other shoulder rubs. To me, it was like, it was like heaven. I actually longed for a cellmate more than I longed for freedom.
And it's amazing what the lack of human contact does, because I think earlier on you would all have made a pact that you weren't going to talk to anyone, but you get to a point of such desperation that any kind of contact, whether it's a guard or a fellow prisoner, you need it, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Sarah, talk about how you ended up making contact with other prisoners.
Do you want me to read that passage? Should I wait?
Yeah, when you meet the other Sarah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I like that.
Did you want me to read the one about the Green Movement and?
Actually, this is an interesting point, because the you mentioned being there after the failed Green Revolution in Iran, and a lot of the dissidents who were rounded up ended up getting sent to, as they would, because that's a notorious mm-hmm. prison where political prisoners get sent. A lot of them got sent to where you were. And so could you read that?
Okay, I'll start with that. It's December 27th. I had a hunch something like this might be coming. I first got wind of it days ago on the news ticker at the bottom of my TV screen. All Iranians should be united on Ashura. This relatively benign statement was followed by a thinly veiled threat. Disruption by hooligans will not be tolerated. The following day, I noticed two new cardboard boxes had arrived at the end of our hallway. After my shower that night, I hastily peeked inside and found dozens of light blue plastic sandals, the ones prisoners have to wear. The guards, I thought, are preparing for an influx. Now, crouched by the bottom of my cell door, I watch a procession of new inmates being led past my cell. One woman has a bandage wrapped around her head, caked in blood. Another limps past, her bright red hair streaming out of her torn headscarf, her head hanging low like a wilting flower. All day I've been desperate to know what's happening beyond these prison walls. Now the streets of Tehran are being brought to me.
Pretty amazing to be a witness to history from it's an awful perspective to have, but...
Yeah, those months. So the Ashura protests happened in December. We were arrested in September in 2009, and we thought the Green Movement had already reached its peak and was pretty much over. And then Ashura happened, which is the end of a holiday in Iranian tradition. And the protests were very violent, and my corridor filled with women. Probably every cell had 12 to 15 women packed in.
And Shane and Josh, you had a little bit of a sense that something was going to happen because of activity in the cell row where you guys were.
Actually, our cell was filled with women, too.
Our
hall. But that was weird because there's about 11 halls in this section 209, and usually the first two or three or three or four are female cells, and then five up to 11 are male cells. But I guess they picked up a disproportionate amount of women because we were on hall five, and that filled up with women, and And for some reason, they decided not to move us, so we were on the female hall.
And well, Shane and Josh, you also had contact with some other prisoners, and did it start with the food?
Oh. Yeah, it did, actually.
Here, we'll explain it to
we were in a cell together, and Sarah had kind of reached out to some other prisoners before that and was caught. And after that, we decided we were not going to communicate with other prisoners because we were seeing each other for about an hour a day in a kind of open air cell. And we were afraid that if we broke the rules, we would not be allowed to see Sarah. So the three of us agreed that we wouldn't communicate, you know, with other prisoners. But there was this guy in the cell next to us that was constantly trying to talk to us. And he spoke Arabic. So it was this kind of rare opportunity to...
You speak Arabic.
Exactly. So we could actually communicate, but we just wouldn't respond to him. And then at one point, we're in our cell and some cakes just fly into our cell, these little like kind of hostess cupcake kind of things. And he was walking past because we didn't have bathrooms in our cell. So when somebody had to go to the bathroom, they would ring a bell and wait for a guard to come and they would take them out. And on his way back from the bathroom, he threw these candies in. And then we eventually agreed that we would reach out to him and kind of had a relationship with that cell for a while. That was when we found out that we were in Evin prison. We learned more about what kind of prison it was. This guy was Saudi and told us that he had been arrested for a visa technicality. He ended up being there for about 2 years. We'd come across him on and off while we were there.
And you had a system of sending information about each other, also around the bathroom, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we would leave candies in the bathroom. He would leave other things, other candies in the bathroom. It kind of became this little moment where they were such risk takers. You know, we were, you know, cautious. We said we don't want to lose this privilege we have of being being together for that hour. But they would, you know, whisper to us, bang on the walls because we shared a common wall. They would communicate with people in all directions so we could get news about, you know, kind of get a landscape of the prison. Because really, even though we had been there for 6 months or so, we didn't know, you know, what other people exactly were here. We didn't know why other people were detained. And I remember he taught us the Farsi word for hostage. And so we used that a lot to the guards, and the guards were like, no, you're not a hostage. And we're like, but Ahmadinejad said he wanted to trade us for prisoners in America. Isn't that the definition of hostage? And so once we learned that word, it became kind of a way to poke at the guards a little bit.
And you also, with this new influx of new prisoners, you were aware of, you heard them being abused, essentially.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were times that we heard of other prisoners being beaten, and Josh and I would get up and pound on the door. And at this time, our interrogators had months before told us that they knew we weren't spies, that our situation had become political, and that it was going to be up to politicians in their government, politicians in our government, to negotiate our release. And when we found that out, we kind of it gave us kind of a sense of a power in a way. I mean, it was scary because we thought we could be there forever, but we also knew we were valuable to the Iranian government. So
it was likely that you would be abused.
Exactly.
So lines they would not cross.
Yeah. So when we heard other people being beaten, we would, you know, kind of cause a commotion, and assuming they wouldn't do that to us. And I remember one time in particular that Josh and I were. We were sitting in our cell, and there was this prisoner who was really broken down. He would, whenever a guard would come to his cell, he would just scream in terror. And I don't know what they did to him, but the guards came to his cell one time and sounded like they were beating him. He was screaming, and we pounded on the door. And this guard came running, and he was angry, and he was like, "What are you doing? Shut up!" And we said, "What is this, Guantanamo?" And he was insulted by that, and and they stopped beating this prisoner, you know.
Wow. Wow.
And I didn't actually hear the women being beaten, but they told me stories of being beaten. At first, I was able to, that time after Ashura, as horrible as it was also a time of, there was a spirit of resistance everywhere. There were long months where no one in my corridor would make a sound. No one would reach out to me in any way. And during that time, the other women would sing down the hallway to me. They sang Michael Jackson's You Are Not Alone. They asked me to sing Celine Dion, which I unfortunately couldn't do. They passed me notes. They would ball them up and throw them through the little window on my door. And the notes would often say things like, we love you. You know, we hope you get out of here. Don't hate Iranian people. And they also told me stories of how they would be tortured. They'd be beaten at the bottom of their feet. So it would be difficult for them to stand.
The people there, I mean, it's really, I can feel people here feel that. And I think it's worth even emphasizing because the people there, so a lot of them were dissidents, and you'd get times when there would be these influx of dissidents, and then you'd get all sorts of people, a guy who converted from Islam to Christianity, a professor who they weren't sure what he was saying when he went to England, and he was back visiting his mother in Iran or something like this. And, you know, when they got out, when these people got out, they would send, like, love letters to our family about, like, you know, how wonderful, you know, was to talk to us and how much they hope we get out, and became, you know, advocates saying, you know, pressure the Iranian government. The way in which our neighbors kind of supported us in this way and taught us these things, like even when Shane talks about how we knocked on the door, you know, I feel like learning that was once when a prisoner in the cell next to me months before was getting beaten. All the other prisoners around us started knocking on the door. So it was like, you know, people there kind of helped initiate us into this how to cope mm-hmm. with a place that they were a lot more. Like familiar. I mean, we knew hunger striking, but they knew a lot more than that, you know?
And that said, I do think that what we touched on and the fact that we were valuable to the Iranian government, you know, we were like money in the bank, and they were eventually going to cash us in. So we couldn't be physically hurt and physically damaged, and the power that gave us. In my interrogations, I had a rule that I established with my interrogators that they couldn't come any closer than 3 feet to me. And it was established early on. I screamed at them to never come closer than 3 feet. And I've told that to other Iranian women who have been in there, and they just like couldn't believe that they actually listened to me. There are many ways that we were able to establish boundaries that couldn't be crossed, that other prisoners could never do.
Sarah, could you read that other excerpt we talked about that was where you meet
Zahra?
Your namesake.
Zahra. I suddenly hear a soft whisper. The voice is close, almost as if it were in my cell. Zahra! My head darts to the right and left, looking for the source of the sound. Am I imagining it? Zahra! The voice is louder now. Please! It seems to be coming from the corner near the door where my sink is. Above the sink is a vent. The vent. As soon as the thought crosses my mind, I leap off my bare mattress, compelled by a force beyond my control, and climb onto the sink. I press my mouth to the vent. Who are you? I ask the voice. How do you know my name? My name is Zahra, almost the same as yours, Sara. I know you. You know me? Yes, I saw your mother on TV. I'm so sorry for you, Sara. I'm a mother, too. Did you talk to my mother? I almost yell it, then remember to hush my voice. As soon as the question escapes my mouth, I realize how irrational it is. No, Sara, but I saw many pictures of you on BBC. You're a small girl. I know it must be easy for you to be standing on the sink. For me, it is difficult. They beat me. They kicked me and tortured me. My hips hurt, and it's difficult for me to stand. Her English is almost perfect, strongly accented with a sensuous, scratchy quality. Why did they arrest you, I asked. I was at the protest, she said. Ashura. Suddenly, the door of my cell bursts open. A guard's small, voluptuous silhouette is outlined in the doorway with her hands on her hips. She must have heard us talking and crept down the hallway, probably shoeless so we wouldn't hear her footsteps, and pounced on us in the middle of our forbidden conversation. It felt like being caught masturbating by a ruthless schoolmarm, like discovering a private secret pleasure and then being exposed and humiliated. This time my pleas have no effects. Layla's kind motherly face slams shut like a steel door. She says she will tell my interrogators what I've done. Zahra, the new prisoner, is immediately transferred.
And do you know what happened to Zahra?
Yeah, well, that was the beginning of our relationship. That time she was transferred, but somehow she made her way back months later. And she was a new prisoner in my cell, and I could see her through the slot in my door when she passed to and from the bathroom. And she always had a pink jumpsuit, and I didn't understand why we all had these, you know, ugly navy blue things, and she had this amazing pink jumpsuit. So I called her Pink Lady, and then she passed me a note, and at first it was just a balled up piece of paper on the floor, and I would crouch down and read it, and she said that it was Zahra, that she was back. And I realized that Pink Lady was Zahra. When people would pass notes like that, I would just eat them afterwards because I'd be afraid that they'd be discovered. We devised a method of communicating that was very intricate. We'd speak to each other down the hallway late at night, and we'd wait until the lazy guard was there, and we knew that she wasn't as on top of us as the others. And I memorized her footsteps and her patterns of walking through the corridors, so I knew when she was going to be away for a few seconds. And I had a small piece of metal. I didn't have a pen, but I had a small piece of metal from a Vaseline tube that could write like a pencil. So we'd write each other notes, and I'd tuck it inside a maxi pad that I would dip inside beef stew so it looked soiled and leave it in the bathroom at the end of the hall. And we communicated that way for weeks. And she was Dutch-Iranian, so we planned on meeting each other in the Netherlands, and we would go dancing and drinking and tell each other our whole life stories and become good friends. And she was just so incredibly defiant. I mean, there were many women there that were defiant, but she would always yell at the guards, and she would just never and sing and laugh, and she had this amazing joyfulness. And after I was released, just several months after I was released, I found out that she was executed. She was picked up at the protest, and they later said they found drugs in her apartment, and she was executed for drug smuggling.
I'm going to take some questions from the audience in a few minutes, but first I should say out, we should, you know, set out how you ended up here with us, with your freedom. I guess it makes sense to start with a man, Salem Ismaili. Who is he, and how did you first become aware of him? It's a businessman, right?
he visited us in prison, and it was this sort of surreal moment where the interrogator said, "You're going to meet somebody. He's from the region," and then we go in there, and this man, a very like regal man, sits us down, and he gives us these like fancy watches and these beautiful dates, and we're sitting there in like prison clothes with our interrogators breathing down our necks, and he says, "Look, I want to, find a way to, you know, have these two countries talk to each other." Kind of goes on, and it seems like he's very much talking to, being very diplomatic and talking to everybody at the same time. And that was the first time, and that was about 8-9 months into our incarceration. But we met him two other times, once when Sarah got released, and another time later.
When we got released.
It was not between mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Then when we got released. And so he was, when the day we got released was... we were just running in circles in the courtyard, Shane and I, getting our little exercise. And then on the way down, we, instead of going back to the cell, the interrogators tell us to go to the nurse. And instead of, we don't know why, but they want to give us our checkout. And then eventually we see this guy, Salem, who we kind of weren't sure. It seemed pretty clear that something good was happening. But until seeing this man who had come before and picked up Sarah and gotten her free and then was going to come back for us, we realized that we were getting free, and so we got on the Sultan's jet, which he had been had waiting for us in Tehran for a week, and he flew us to Oman.
And Salim, he got involved in our case after, I think, 2 months. He knew that we were innocent. He knew this was going to cause a lot of problems. And he took the case very personally, as did the Sultan of Oman. But he also had an eye for a much larger picture. He was involved in opening up the path for nuclear negotiations between the U.S. and Iran. And we later found out that our case played a small role in that, that in his efforts to you know, end our ordeal, there was a, you know, more of a willingness from high-level Iranian officials and U.S. officials to meet. And after Shane and Josh's release, they did meet in Oman, and that paved the way for the historic nuclear deal that happened.
That was the highest-level contact there had been in a while, and these are the same mm-hmm. people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
That's kind of amazing.
And there are many countries involved. Oman was probably the most involved, but Iraq, Turkey, Senegal, Sarah got President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela involved through Sean Penn. You know, there's international media. It was really a kind of international effort. Yeah. And a campaign that was led by our families, especially our mothers.
Before we throw it out to the audience, well, this is kind of a random question, but it's something that stuck out over the course of this narrative, because I've read other prison narratives before and familiar with some conditions, but one thing, the blindfold. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's something particular about Iranian prisons, but they blindfolded you so much. It sounds like it's an awful, disorienting thing that was just a regular feature.
It was really weird. I mean, it's like, in the beginning, it was really frightening, you know, you... Every time you leave your cell, you have to be blindfolded. You don't see anything. When you're interrogated, you don't see them. But if you're there long enough, it's you end up seeing everything because you put your blindfold up. You know, you look under your blindfold, and it was just kind of this. You know, it was just used as a way to kind of intimidate, to disorient people. And, you know, a lot of guards would kind of initially not want us to see their faces, but then eventually we would, you know.
And, Sarah, you were released almost a year before Shane and Josh. When you were first released, after all those awful moments that you'd had where you thought you were going to be free early on, at what point did you believe it?
Believe that I was free?
Yeah, this is going to happen, that I'm actually going to be free now.
Well, when they first took me out of my cell without Shane and Josh, I was just really pissed off, and I told them, go get Shane and Josh. I mean, we always demanded to do everything together. And then I saw Salim, and I started to get a hint of what was happening, and I told him, there's no way I'm not going. You can't take me out of here without them. But I looked in his eyes, and when it sunk in that I could make a difference, that that I could get them out sooner, I knew that it was what needed to be done.
And then when you met Secretary of State Clinton and the President, that was pretty much the first thing you said to them, right?
Yeah. Well, I had my demands. it was clear from Salim, from the perspective of the Iranian government, they'd already given two good gestures. They'd let our mothers come, and now they'd let me go. And they weren't going to let them go without a good gesture in return. And it was very frustrating because there's no political will on either side to change their relationship. You know, now we have this opening, and it seems, it seems natural. It could have happened 25 years ago, you know, but the reason these things take so long is both sides are locked in a destructive relationship, and we had a taste of those consequences.
It's just an amazing moment, you know, reading it, because you've been in a freaking Iranian prison for that amount of time. I'd expect you to be, I don't know, just kind of worn out, and then your first words with the Secretary of State is like, you're telling her, maybe not stabbing the ear with your finger, but we have to get my friends out. You have to do something.
I was really running on autopilot. I felt a lot like a machine for a long time. I would eat food, but I wouldn't taste it. And I just sort of took myself out of the equation and ran with it, you know, hit the ground running. But it reminded me, when you get out of prison, you're in the world, but prison is still in you. And a lot of the confrontations that I would have with Hillary Clinton, President Ahmadinejad, you know, getting them to lock eyes, Oprah, not backing down, it reminded me of confrontations with guards, you know, with interrogators. It didn't feel that different.
Yeah. So some questions from the audience now. We have microphones around.
I'd like to know, what were they looking for from you? Were they seeking confessions or admissions that you'd done something wrong? What did it seem to be their purpose beyond using you as just a trading chip?
I don't think they knew. You know, I think some people had different ideas at different times, but I don't think they were that coherent of a group, the Iranian government. I mean, I think there was a time where they tried to get me to confess. They were saying, you know, Shane and Sarah have confessed. Why don't you confess? And we were isolated, so there'd be no way for me to check. And of course, they didn't. But, and that would have helped them. You know, that was their idea of the day. You know, it seemed like, you know, they asked me how many times do I know Hillary Clinton? Do I know these various officials? As if I was about to give them some big nugget. But they, I think, you know, the whole interrogation ended after 2 months. So, you know, I think it was really a matter of weeks where they were realizing that, like, we're dead ends for any intelligence.
But even after that, the interrogations, there was, you know, many things happening within the Iranian government around our case. I think, you know, we were stuck between Iran and the U.S., but we were also stuck between different parties within Iran. There were President Ahmadinejad at some point, we were later told, wanted to release us, but the judiciary was, you know, was against him, and they had more power in as far as dealing with prisoners, so they could refuse. So we were kind of used in power games within Iran too. So it wasn't as if the whole government was of one mind. I mean, like most governments, you know, there's different forces at play.
With the understanding that you were somewhat privileged when you were imprisoned in Iran, could you compare and contrast conditions and treatment based on your understanding between, say, Pelican Bay or a maximum security prison in the United States and what you experienced or witnessed in Iran?
Hmm. Just about a month ago, I went to visit some of the people that I write at Pelican Bay. And one of them has been in solitary confinement for 27 years. So the scale is astronomical, and he's in for gang validation, so it's indefinite, and there's a very likely possibility he'll never get out. He was one of the people that started the hunger strike, but the historic largest hunger strike in history. Also, they meet people through glass, so he hasn't, as far as I know, touched anyone in several decades other than guards, and the guards hate him. When Shane went to Pelican Bay, he went inside a cell, and the cells have no windows, and our cells had windows, even though they were covered with bars and perforated metal. Natural light would come in, hence the title, A Sliver of Light, would move across the wall of our cell every day.
Well, I think amongst in the part of the prison we were in Iran, we were in a political ward, so it was very different from, you know, we were never in the general population. But what we heard from guards, at least about the general population, is that it was very violent. But the political ward was different. I mean, we were all isolated from each other for one, so we didn't have contact. But there was the strong sense of solidarity that we talked about. But you know, it was nothing like, you know, American prisons are incredibly violent places. But, you know, it seemed like the general population in the Iranian prison was similar.
Would you care to tell us something about your dreams since you were released, including up till today, and how prison plays in them?
I had a... I don't really...
Or like sleeping dreams?
Yeah. Yeah. I had dreams for a while. Actually, while I was in prison, pretty much every night I would dream about escaping or getting released, and I would get released and then have to suddenly go back to prison. It was like constantly reoccurring dream.
We used to call them temporary freedom dreams.
Yeah. And when I got out, I had dreams that I was getting put back in prison for a long time. And there was a lot going on. I mean, the transition coming out of prison was very difficult in many ways. And when I would be really dealing with kind of a lot of post-traumatic stress, I remember having dreams about our main interrogator, who we call Dumb Guy. And I would just scream at him or punch him in the face over and over again. And I would just be shouting my lungs out at him, you know. Mm-hmm. But I haven't had those in a long time. But there was a period where if something would be going in my life as difficult, I would have a prison dream again.
Really similar for me. But when I got out, the first year that I was out without them, I used to dream that I was back in prison. And frighteningly, they were good dreams. A part of me wanted to be back. Something I used to write to Shane is that home was wherever he is, and I wanted to be home with him.
Should point out, you two got engaged during the course of this awful period.
We did.
Yeah.
And we got, sent us books, and somebody sent us The Interpretation of Dreams by Sigmund Freud. Have you heard of it? And so Shane and I became expert dream interpreters, and because our unconsciouses were, it was hard to differentiate whose unconscious was thinking in that 10x14 cell after being there for a couple years together. It was kind of, we'd wake up and Shane would tell me his dream, and I would know everything that happened in his day. So and week and month and year before, so it was ripe for that. But it was also hard to figure out, you know, what had changed in the theories of dream psychology in the past 110 years. And then I'll just say about my dreams, you know, when I got, I didn't have too many of these dreams. The big thing was that I would, there was like this ambiguous prison. I was like kind of in prison, but there were no walls. And then there was like a gate, but not a, I wasn't like sure whether I was in or out for a period after I was released.
Well, I was going to ask you how, Shane and Josh, how did you know that she was actually free? But I guess she was able to send letters to you from your previous question. But how did you feel knowing that she was free and you were still in prison?
To the first question, you know, we were seeing each other every day for about an hour a day, and Sarah demanded that she be allowed to see us before we go, so we actually had a last visit together. And then we saw her on TV right after that. So that was, you know, we weren't sure what had happened until we saw her giving a press conference in New York. We had a TV. We didn't have it the whole time, but after about 6 months, I think we got a TV. We had Iranian state TV. We'd have a couple of English language news segments on it, which were really bad. What was the other? Oh, right. It felt like a huge relief. Sarah was, you know, the fact that she was alone and that Josh and I were together was that fact was kind of the center of our lives. You know, we were constantly demanding that she be given a cellmate. When we would go outside, it was, you know, Josh and I would plan for the day of how to kind of bring Sarah up, because she would get really hit really low points. And there were times that I just felt so desperate and thought that the Sarah that came out might not be the same person that I knew going in. So when she got out, that was that burden was lifted, you know, of worrying about her, and we knew that she was going to be fighting for us, and that she would kind of give this new voice, a new insight to the campaign for us, because she was coming from in there. But over time, you know, Sarah leaving shrunk our world, you know, by a third. We were then two people and who had no way of separating. So as time went on, you know, we, Josh and I, you know, found ourselves kind of arguing over where to put a bottle in our cell, where to store it, because we used bottles as weights to exercise. And, you know, we kind of tore up our cell one day, deciding whether we were going to put it in the bathroom where I wanted it or under the bed where Josh wanted it. And, you know,
we threw it in the trash.
Yeah. it would get absurd, you know, that we were just, we had no way of separating from each other, you know.
You talked about coming out of it as different people. I mean, you maintain the connection, obviously, but you have to come out of this as a different person, don't you? I saw they were able to recover from your camera the photographs you took on that day. I can't imagine how strange it must be to look at your former
self. It is strange.
Yeah.
I mean, it just felt like that this moment when we see those photos that we had no idea what was ahead, you know? And it's like, when I look at myself then, I seem so innocent, you know? I wasn't innocent, but after going through 2 years in prison, it's, right. It feels different, you know?
Hi, this question's for Josh. I'm just curious, did they ever find out you were Jewish and your connection to Israel? And if so, did they treat you differently?
Yeah. Well, I told them my first interrogation, they said, what is your religion? So I said, Christian. And then they said, okay. And then that lasted like 10 days. They got into my email. I gave them a password. And, you know, there's enough references to whatever. Are you coming home for the holidays? Coming home for Passover? I remember one of my cousins on my father's side sent all these pictures with a bunch of Hebrew captions. I was like, I remember receiving it and being like, I can't understand the words. But, so they were onto where I was from. And so then I just told them, because it was like, it kind of became this big thing of like, why am I hiding, you know, something that I'm not, that doesn't make me a spy, right? I had to reaffirm that to myself, right? That doesn't make me a spy. And no, you know, they ended up giving me, you know, the same food, the same amount of time in the courtyard, this ultimately the same punishment. And it really, you know, they reacted, people reacted differently. And it was a real mixture of like curiosity and suspicion. And the interrogators were suspicious, but a lot of guards were curious. You know, they would say, Jew, no problem. Israel, problem. Really separate that out.
I know it's much diminished, but there's still a healthy Jewish community remaining in Iran.
It's the largest Jewish community in the Middle East outside of Israel, is in Iran. So there, you know, there's this sense that when enough guards repeated something, I had the sense that this was part of their education, you know, or television upbringing or whatever it is. And that was one of those things. Jew, no problem, Israel problem. The other one was, you know, Jew, and they'd point to these guys who are secular, and they'd say, Christian, me, Muslim, and they say, one God. You know, people of the book. So it says, okay, you know, this is common ground. You know, I felt like, you know, so there was like a reaching out about it. And you know, ultimately, in the courtroom, that was pretty much the evidence of my guilt, was that my heritage. But the evidence of Shane's guilt was that he was a journalist and had gone to Baghdad. So it was all fabricated anyway. And so in that sense, I guess that's some of the ways really it played out.
Next time, two more questions.
Thank you. I have three questions, and any one of you can answer it, about culture. What American song stood in your head? What American food did you miss? And did you ever think that America would give up on you?
Ooh. Songs. There were once when we were in the open air cell, we went through every decade and came up with every song we could think of from the 60s and 70s and 80s. What were some of the big ones?
We had, you know, with my, you know, the Swiss visited us a couple times because they represent the U.S. interests in Iran without an embassy there. And so I remember when they visited us the first time, I said, you know, tell my family, any day now, I shall be released. Mm-hmm. There's another like 700 of those any day nows. But that was one of those first songs. And the song we had together as a, we started using, or we used and kind of had as backup songs as code language, because the courtyard, you could kind of hear, if you sang loud enough, you could hear from the cell a song from the courtyard. So we had another Dylan song was The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, which is the song about injustice that we would sing. And I think it was This Land Is Your Land we would sing, which would mean, you know, we're on hunger strike or something. Mm-hmm. Like that.
I remember when Josh and I got put together, you know, we were just coming out of solitary, and it was amazing to be able to talk. And we didn't really have much. We didn't have many books at that time. And I remember giving Josh, we were kind of sharing knowledge, and I gave him like a lesson of the Balkan Wars, and he gave me this kind of life story of Bob Dylan. And but later, after Sarah got out, she sent us a book of all of the lyrics of all of Dylan's songs up to 2006 or something, and which was amazing. It was kind of like having a radio, because we, you know, Josh and we both knew a lot of like the tunes, you know, so we could just have the lyrics and sing. We'd just sit and sing these songs together.
And Sarah wrote some of her own songs there.
Yeah,
I wrote a bunch of songs.
Beautiful songs we had.
Yeah. And a food you guys missed the most?
Coffee.
Oh yeah, definitely. And yes, many times we feared we'd be forgotten by our government, but never by our friends and family. And that makes a huge difference psychologically. I mean, not forgotten by our government, but that our government wouldn't be willing to do what it would take to get us out. Many prisoners feel completely forgotten, and I have no idea how you get through a day in prison without the knowledge that people are fighting for you on the outside.
You touched on this a little bit, but I'm curious to hear more about how the experience transformed you. And you talk about how you went out in those pictures, you were so innocent. How do you feel the weight of this experience for you moving forward? And then also just personally, how has it changed the relationship? What's it like, especially Josh, now that you're on your own, and also the two of you, I mean, are you on your own? What's it like not to be together anymore?
No, you know, in solitary confinement, just facing, I thought like, okay, I got to come up with things to occupy my mind. So I thought, all right, from now on every day, I'm going to start with my first memories, and every day I'll think about everything that happened in that, and when I was 6, and then tomorrow I'll think about everything that happened when I was 7 years old and go up. Now that's sort of the, whatever, however many weeks. And so just thinking about life and what I've done and who I am and this sort of thing. I remember just going over systematically like every relationship I have, and family relationships first and then friends, and thinking about have I been my best self in every relationship, and you know, and could get very critical of myself in solitary confinement. And I think that probably more than anything else became something that I like try to hold on to in the free world, which is just when everything gets stripped away, all you have are your memories and your dreams, and you have a sense of what relationships you have. And so that's really central to how I hope I've changed. And when we got out, it was really hard, you know, especially at first. We spent the first few days in Oman, and I just remember, you know, being in this big group of people would be, you know, my family, Shane's family, and Sarah, and everyone would be talking, and if I looked at Shane, I knew exactly what he was thinking, and I could tell he knew exactly what I was thinking. There was not anything that happened. You relate it to the past, and for me, the past was a couple years in prison. So, you know, those first few months, we were together here and there, but we were pretty separate. And that, I remember it being pretty hard. I remember kind of not quite having, feeling like knowing how to, move on from prison. And I guess, you know, just sort of lesson and this sort of thing, I feel a sense of, okay, we were a statistic. We were the three Americans in Iran, three hikers, whatever. And I feel this sense of, like, what's really at stake? I feel like, you know, life and the sense of suffering that I had no idea previous to this. And so, I've moved on in life. I have a partner, I have a child, and I feel like when I'm, you know, with my child and thinking about this, I really feel like, what's at stake here with these kind of political games that our governments play.
I'll keep it brief, but I mean, so many people don't get out. So many people don't make it. And our story is really about that too. It's about the horror of losing your freedom and the miracle of getting it back, and it's about the people that don't. And that gives me a real sense of increased responsibility. I think it sort of might, I feel like experience like the one that we've had, it amplifies everything. I feel like it amplified my personality. I already had a lot of responsibility, but now I feel it even more. And really just loving my country, feeling a real sense of responsibility to what's wrong here and wanting to be a part of making it right. And that focuses on prison and solitary confinement. But I feel the same kind of enhanced responsibility to like enjoy my free time to its fullest and just have a fabulous life.
I was going to give one anecdote. Just you asked about our relationships now. There in the book we write about, there were some of the tense times between the three of us. You know, there was just we were under so much pressure that sometimes you know, difficulties emerged between us. And after getting out of prison, there were a lot of things that happened in prison that we had to kind of work through, because when these things would come up, prison isn't the place to kind of deal with your problems, you know. We would just kind of move past it and just, you know, okay, let's keep going forward, you know. So when we got out, we had to kind of deal with these things, you know. And there were things that, you know, Sarah and I would try to talk about, and we just couldn't. There were some things that we just couldn't talk about. And there's a scene in the book that is the only scene that's written in the third person, and it was a moment where there had been a couple instances of violence between me and a couple guards and Josh. And after I got in a fight with a guard, there was kind of a tense moment with Sarah and I where, you know, she was afraid of us getting torn apart, and there was just all this crazy stuff happening. And when we got to that point in the book, in writing about the book, we were like, okay, we have to deal with this now. We're going to write about it, you know?
Yeah.
And what we ended up doing is in our house, we had two offices in our apartment, and we sat in our two offices and opened up a Google Doc. And we basically recounted the conversation that we had after that fight happened. And it was kind of an argument. And we decided, you know, we would each take turns saying what we said, and on a separate document, we would write our thoughts. So we had this dialogue, and then afterwards, we put our thoughts into the document. And doing that really made us both able to kind of see what was going on with the other person at that time and what they were thinking. And it kind of helped us, made it possible for us to kind of work through this thing that we just couldn't really talk about.
You might want to try that sometime.
You turn relationship counselor. Brilliant, actually. Shane, Sarah, Josh, thank you so much. This is it's an amazing book.
Thank
Three
you.
Of you are amazing people.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.